Welcome back to Broad Appeal. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
And we are here for part two of Glenda Jackson, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy, or as I like to call it, Sean, Unsolved Mysteries.
Very good, Brian.
I know you liked to watch that as a kid.
I did.
Now, you might be saying, but a touch of class is not a mystery. No, folks. It's nominally a romantic comedy. The mystery, however, how on earth does anyone think this film is any good? If you've never seen A Touch of Class, as probably 90%, 95, 97? 99%. 99% of the people out there have never seen it. You've surely heard of it. Little peek behind the curtain, okay? Even before we started doing this podcast, Sean and I would occasionally spend a weekend evening just watching an old movie starring a woman. It's true. It's something we actually do for fun, not just for the podcast.
And then we thought we'd monetize it, but that hasn't been doing very well either, has it?
Yeah, Patreon.
Patreon. Okay, this note here says Patreon.
Patreon. Anyway, so a few years ago, we said, you know what? We've never seen iconic Oscar-winning film, A Touch of Class. We love Glenda Jackson.
Yeah, like most things of Glenda, we'd heard of it. We knew it was of a time and of a particular good quality. And we'd been recommended by a friend of ours that we had to see it.
Yeah, a friend had said she'd seen it and she just thought it was the most delightful romantic comedy. That friend is going to remain nameless because she is wrong.
Yes. I mean, on paper, the film is described as a story about a feminist who gets involved with a married man. And I'm like, wait a second, with that plot in 1973 and Glenda Jackson? Oh my God, this film is going to be amazing.
This just has to be good.
George Segal and Glenda Jackson in the greatest love story of our time.
It's also produced by Brut. That's right. The fragrance company.
Yes, which is a subsidiary of Fabergé.
So, I mean, when we're talking about A Touch of Class, it's got class written all over it. Okay, my experience with A Touch of Class, I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before. In my youth, I had a VHS tape entitled Oscar's Greatest Moments. It came out around 1990, 1991, and it focuses entirely on the Oscar ceremonies from 1970 to 1990. And among the many things that it does is it has montages of all the Best Actor and Best Actress winners. And I was always fascinated when they were going through year by year and they got to A Touch of Class with Glenda Jackson, because she's there in a kind of sharp, severe bob in a kitchen berating someone and saying, and the baseball, and the golf. And I just thought to myself, who is this woman? What is this movie? It must be a kind of one of those searing 1970s satirical comedies about sex, you know, in the vein of like Carnal Knowledge or something like that.
Yes, he comes over to her and she goes, do not touch me. Do not. And you're like, oh my God, some searing moment is happening in this biting satire.
Okay, so this is a few years ago. Sean and I sit down to watch A Touch of Class. The first thing that happens is we hear a doopy-doopy, plunky-plunky theme song.
Ploppy-ploppy.
Which can only be called reminiscent of a situation comedy. Now, we have since learned the real song, but in Sean's hazy memory, what is the title song to A Touch of Class?
Yeah, so it's not quite this, but it's something like this. It's, what do you get when you fall in love? You get a little touch of class. Bum, bum, bum.
Okay. Do, 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 do. Okay, that is not the real song, but for years that's what we thought it was. Now when we've rewatched the movie for the podcast, we have confirmed that indeed the title song to A Touch of Class is signaling to you heavily sitcom.
Yes.
Okay. The opening credit sequence involves a shot of the River Thames and the Houses of Parliament, where the water is kind of lapping on the shores, and then it freeze frames, and in a bold orange font, it says, A Touch of Class. And you know, Sean, the other thing, the way in which this movie is like a sitcom, do you know how sitcoms always have names that don't really mean anything? Like, family matters, you know, growing pains. It's just like they came up with some phrase that really has nothing to do with anything, right? Mm-hmm. What does a touch of class have to do with anything in this movie?
Well, I'm just trying to think, like, happy days, I'm guessing they're happy, you know? Full House, the house is quite busy.
Okay, Full House, to be honest, is because it's about the union of multiple families and there's many people in the house.
Friends is about friends, but, like...
Do you know what I mean?
Rising Damp.
That's a sitcom.
Yeah, Rising Damp, that's a great theme tune as well.
As Time Goes By with Judi Dench. I mean, it's just literally like, let's pick a phrase out of a hat and name our show that. So it's literally like, they're like, it's produced by Fabergé. It has a British woman in it. It takes place in London. Let's call it A Touch of Class. Is this movie about class in any way?
No.
Is it about touching? I suppose, sort of.
Yeah, not really, though.
So the actual theme tune, I mean, this theme tune makes Alan and Marilyn Bergman and their lyrics seem like, you know, Cole Porter.
Hey, they're pretty good, you know.
Alan and Marilyn Bergman are good.
They wrote Windmills of My Mind.
I know they did. I love them. I've invoked them more often than any other public figure.
We should find out if they were nominated for Best Song this year, because Lord knows this title theme was.
You've just mentioned the nominations, Sean. So this movie got nominations for Best Song.
Yes.
Best Actress.
Best Original Score.
Best Original Score, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Picture.
Best effing picture.
What were these people smoking in 1973?
Peyote, I think.
I mean, honestly, maybe there weren't that many sitcoms on TV, and somehow they needed this. They thought, like, what a refreshing little, you know, palate cleanser, A Touch of Class. You know, I've just seen The Exorcist, and now I want to, like...
That is true. So in the same year, The Exorcist and A Touch of Class were in the same category, twice at least.
Okay, okay.
We should say that, you know, when we say it's sitcom-y, we're not just, you know, saying that to make fun of it lightly. It is paced like a sitcom. You're waiting for a laughter track. Everything about it, it looks like a sitcom. It looks cheap. Maybe it could have been the print that we were watching, but it is a sitcom-y. Well,
no one has restored A Touch of Class.
No, Criterion have left it alone.
Okay, and can I just give you some of the memorable lyrics from the real theme song to A Touch of Class?
Yeah, let's try to sing it together.
What he has is sheer pizzazz, plus
little touch of class.
Something, something, something else, plus
little touch of class.
I mean, it's literally like...
And you can get the trumpet going.
Okay, sorry. We've not even got to the film. But I have to say, Sean, the reason why this boggles me, it's not just that this was a fluke Academy Award for Glenda. She also, in the same year, won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy or Musical.
Understandable.
Yeah, perhaps that's understandable. Comedy, they often say, gets more dated as time goes by. But she was also the runner-up for the New York Film Critics Best Actress Award. Like, clearly, people in 1973 thought this movie was really good, was awards-worthy good.
Yeah, actually, if you watch the Oscar clip that year with the other nominees for Best Actress, who were Marsha Mason for Cinderella Liberty, and
Joanne Woodward.
Joanne Woodward for Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams.
Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams.
Ellen Barkin.
No, Burstyn. Ellen Burstyn.
I never get them right. Ellen Burstyn for The Exorcist, and probably the most egregiously overlooked as winner, Barbra Streisand in The Way We Were.
Okay, you know that Sean and I have ragged on Barbra Streisand many times, but if she came home and smashed a mirror from having lost to Glenda for A Touch of Class...
And, like, said to Elliot, like...
Oh, she was already divorced from Elliot by this time. Yeah, said to...
Kicked one of her dogs.
She was in between Elliot and John Peters at this point, I think. Barbara couldn't get a leg in for The Mirror Has Two Faces. Like, The Mirror Has Two Faces and A Touch of Class are, like, on the exact same plane. And
I actually think Mirror Has Two Faces is better.
It's better, it's more interesting, it is more sophisticated, and it's funnier.
Yeah. I should finish by saying that when Glenda's name is called out of the envelope, the three actresses who are there in the audience look not only confused but pissed off. Like, it's one of those rare moments where everyone's kind of like, what?
Yeah, and brilliantly, wasn't Glenda there neither of the times to pick up her Academy Awards?
She presented the Best Actor Award the next year to Art Carney for Harry and Tonto.
With Glenda's resurgence, do you think they might bring her back to the Oscars this year? Because she has wonderful pronunciation. Our favorite is for The Godfather Part 2.
Al Pacino. I'm sorry for that plosive P there, Brian, but it was necessary. She won't go.
Something about the Academy Awards in the 1970s, the amount of times that people didn't show was really remarkable.
Well, I figured they were usually on Broadway or something. Or
I think they were just, you know, smoking dope and taking lewds, you know? And also, I love how they'll have the people in the audience in those little boxes, and then the other people have, like, their headshots.
Yeah.
And there'll literally be, like, three headshots and only two people.
Do you ever notice that some of the headshots they use when someone isn't there are really poor? It's like, I remember one time when Judi Dench wasn't there for like Notes on a Scandal or something, or
they probably took her shot from a Hampstead Bazaar.
But it's that quality. It's like I had taken a photo of her on a digital camera with two people either side of her and then badly cropped them out.
Maybe like blurred their faces the way people do like, on dating apps.
I never really understand the Oscars. The one thing it never does right is choose the correct photo.
Okay, we're beating around the bush. Suffice it to say, you are not dreaming. Glenda Jackson did win an Academy Award for A Touch of Class. Sean, can we dissect this movie and try to figure out what on earth people in 1973 saw in this?
Well, let's say what it's about, first of all.
Yes.
Okay, so Glenda Jackson plays fashion designer and divorcee of two children, Vicky Alessio.
Just a point of information, she's not a fashion designer.
Yeah, you're right, she's a thief. Very ahead of her time, really. You know, Topshop basically built their whole reputation on this. She sends people
To Paris. To the runway shows, you know, Dior, Givenchy.
Yeah.
I love the way she says that.
And then she copies them.
Yeah. So basically, she works in the London rag trade, as she says. She's divorced from an Italian man. That's why she's named Vicky Alessio.
Yes, and she meets in
Kensington Park, I think. Is there a baseball
team? Hyde Park? Would that make more sense?
I don't know. Somewhere over there.
She's walking with her kids in one of the West End parks. And her child is literally trampled down by George Segal, and his character's name is
Steve Blackburn. So he's there playing softball, and they have this kind of classic meet cute, right? Where he says, "Hey lady, would you give me my ball back?
Hey mister, would you give me my child back?"
Okay, you started that impersonation as Barbara Streisand and you were Glenda Jackson by the end. Could you do that again?
No, I won't actually. I think that was perfectly fine.
Trying to redress the Academy's wrongs. Okay, and this is where the sitcom-y stuff starts. So we actually return to the theme tune as the credits keep going, and we see George Segal walking to the Bank of England. And as he's doing so, he looks in a bus, and there's Glenda again. Oh my god, they're second running into each other.
It's like the title sequence is played at the start of every episode.
Yeah. You expect George Segal to, like, toss a hat in the air and, like, have a freeze frame. Then it's a rainy day, because, of course, it's London, it always rains, and he runs for a cab, and who is running for the exact same cab? Only the same woman that he's already run into two times.
You mean Vicky Alessio?
Vicky Alessio, whose name he doesn't yet know. So they get in the cab, and he says, "Shall we share the cab?" Okay. Now, this is the point where I think the movie has a little bit of charm, okay? We can buy they've run into each other three times. He's a brash American, a dreadful Yank, and she's a kind of classy British woman, yeah? Mm-hmm. We think this is a recipe for something that's going to be really delightful. And as they're driving in the cab, I mean, George Segal boldly comes on to her, right?
Yeah.
He starts interrogating her about her life. Okay, why is she named Alessio? Well, her husband lives in Milan, and actually he's not her husband anymore. He's her ex-husband. And where is his wife? Well, his wife is back in New York. You know, I'm never unfaithful to her when I'm in the same city. Okay, and here's where I think, like, I can begin to understand why this movie seemed interesting, because it's about two people who decide to begin an affair very matter-of-factly.
Uh-huh.
He basically says to her, let's have tea at the Churchill. They come and have tea. There's more witty banter of Americanness versus British cool. And then he invites her upstairs.
So this is the thing. I can totally get on board with the film at this point.
Yeah.
Because it's like, wow, two mature consenting adults who've decided that they want to have sex with each other.
And I think they even refer to it as something like healthy, completely uncomplicated sex.
Yeah, don't they call it NSA? I think they say NSA at one point.
That's exactly right. They meet each other and Glenda says, hey mate, into?
Yeah, and he asks her if she's verse, and you know, the film just carries on.
Then they exchange peach and aubergine emoji.
God, they would have no idea what we're talking about if they heard this right now.
Oh, Glenda's on all the apps.
No, I mean, yeah, but I mean talking about time traveling here.
Yeah, this is our gay remake, which is known as A Touch of Ass.
Oh, Brian, that was my joke.
Sorry. So, up until this point, they go up to the hotel room above when they're having tea for this aforementioned quickie. And this was the bit that I didn't actually remember until we rewatched it. Glenda is thoroughly unimpressed by the state of this hotel room, right? She basically senses that George Segal has done this sort of thing before.
Yeah, she senses that she's in a knocking shop. Have you heard the expression before?
I've never heard that expression before.
It's what my mother uses to describe poor quality hotels.
Well, in the past 2 days, you have picked me up in the rain, given me tea, bought me lunch, and lured me to this hideaway with the intention, I presume, of getting me into bed for what you Americans so charmingly call a quickie. Is that a fair resume so far?
Why do women always think the worst? Why does sex always have to be the first thing that... Yes.
This is basically the exact same kind of place where George Segal has bedded other women while his wife is out of town, yeah? And she says, I'm not going to do this here. What I want you to do is take me on a weekend.
Weekend.
A weekend as far away from London as possible, preferably somewhere warm where the sheets are changed. So this is what I couldn't deal with. They begin to arrange a very complicated holiday, okay? So Glenda wants a weekend away where they can have a fuck fest, yeah? They've never even kissed at this point in the movie that we've seen.
I know plenty of guys who've organized a fuck fest without ever having kissed before.
Yeah, but not in Malaga when they live in London.
Tel Aviv, maybe.
So basically, George Segal now goes to all these absurd complications. He doesn't just organize a weekend. He organizes an entire week's holiday. He looks at the weather predictions. He sees that Malaga is going to be very sunny.
And bear in mind, this isn't like going onto lastminute.com.
No, he has to do it in the old-fashioned way.
Like, he has to go to a travel agent. He has to find out the weather report first to choose destination.
From the newspaper.
Yeah, then he goes to a travel agent, you know, to Iberia, I believe.
The travel agent this is the beginning of the kind of sitcom-y type reaction shots from, like, memorable cameo characters. Her name is Miss Ramos, or Ramos, as George Segal says. And you and I both had the exact same reaction as soon as we saw Miss Ramos. We both said one word to each other, Meryl. What do we mean?
I know her name is Miss Ramos, but she's clearly not Spanish. She's, like, an Italian. And basically, she is Francesca Johnson. She is Meryl Streep, both in tone of voice, delivery, and side profile, as Meryl is in The Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah. So, despite the fact that they're completely open with one another about having an affair, George Segal still wants to preserve some semblance of dignity. So he says that he's buying tickets to Malaga for himself and for his dear mother,
yes,
Mrs. Alessio.
She remarried.
But of course, then Glenda walks in and says, yes, I'm Mrs. Alessio. And then Miss Ramos raises a skeptical eye. This all gets further complicated when it's the day before they're getting ready to go off on this dirty week in Malaga.
Dirty weekend.
But it's not a weekend, darling. It's a week, an entire week. We have to say, Glenda conveniently, she has children at the beginning of the movie. She conveniently is able to dump her children for an entire week.
For an entire movie.
And they never explain where they go.
No, never. Okay?
They have an entire scene explaining to us what she does with her two dogs, two cats, and two birds. What does she have to do with those?
She drops them off at her gay assistant's home.
She has a gay colleague.
Probably
who literally,
in Rose Court.
Have you ever noticed that gay men, except for Peter Finch in Sunday Bloody Sunday, every other gay man in a 1970s movie always wears a muumuu?
He wasn't wearing a muumuu, was
he? Was. When she comes to his house, his name is Cecil, okay? Mm-hmm. He's wearing, like, this flowing, like...
It's more batik, of a kaftan.
A kaftan, muumuu.
Muumuus are for... Aren't muumuus for big, overweight people?
I think a kaftan is as well.
Okay.
Anyway, he looks like Meryl in The Post. Yeah, he's, like, wearing a, like, flowing robe. He can't believe he has to take care of her. Two dogs, two cats, and two birds. She's all rip-roaring and ready to go. She's ready to get to Heathrow to meet George Segal. But George Segal has complications because who showed up at his Mayfair pied-à-terre?
His wife, his goddamn wife, children,
and in-laws.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is where the sitcom, like, structure of the thing becomes complicated. Because we get about 10 minutes where George Segal has to, like, make excuses for why he's going on a business trip to Spain. Then the in-laws are like, why don't you take your wife with you? Then he has to call Miss Ramos and say, I'm gonna take my wife. And she's like, as well as your mother? And then the wife is like, well, what if we take the kids? And then they're like, the in-laws will be upset too. And then he has to call Miss Ramos back and get tickets for the kids. Yes. And then get tickets for the in-laws.
Yeah, I know Brian's going on here, but that's the tone and that's the speed of the film.
And you kind of think, okay, well, this actually is going to be interesting because we're going to get to Malaga and George Segal's going to be with the wife and the in-laws and the kids and he's going to have to sneak out to meet Vicky. No.
No, it's all resolved.
After 10 minutes of complication, he just basically convinces his wife somehow that she won't like the trip, and they just cancel all the tickets. And that was like a 10-minute gag with no payoff. It literally makes no sense.
No, and actually, there's several gags with no payoff in this film.
So he arrives at the airport with Vicky. They kind of have to pretend that they don't know each other, and they particularly do when they run into yet another memorable character actor and father.
Father of a pivotal person in the Me Too's movement.
Mm-hmm.
In the Time's Up movement.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Sorvino.
That's right. Paul Sorvino as George Segal's loud, obnoxious friend. Now, Paul Sorvino in this movie is not allowed to be Italian, even though he's very noticeably Italian, because he says things like fakakta and schmuck all the time.
They're Jewish words.
They're Yiddish words.
Yeah, so he's not Italian.
I know, but Paul Sorvino is Italian, is what I'm saying.
But, like...
Why can't he just be Italian?
Yeah, but you're brave, okay? Paul Sorvino, not unlike yourself, can pass for a Nero Jew.
According to you. Anyway, Paul Sorvino is so happy to see his old chum that he wants to sit next to him on the plane, and Vicky has to sit in the back, and then he's still talking to him. He's like some sort of, like, financier of movies, and he has, like, some movie script that he's talking to Paul Sorvino about. Little does he know that George Segal is there to have an affair with Vicky.
To get his end in.
Then they get to the rental car place on the other end in Spain, and there's only one car left that is at all properly functioning. And Paul Sorvino is like, this is great. You and I can drive to the hotel together. But of course, George has to drive with Glenda. So George makes more convoluted excuses for why Paul Sorvino ought to take the good car. And Glenda and George end up driving in a really out-of-date Fiat 600 with a bad clutch.
Yeah, like tiny, tiny thing, like a smart car.
Yeah, it's a very, very small car. Glenda makes a lot of gags about trying to fit her luggage in and, you know, the cramp she's going to have in her knees and things like that. But the real gag of getting in this car is what, Sean?
It's the noise. It's the green diesel. It's the thumping and throding and pumping of this little tiny thing, this little tin, up the motorway.
So George is trying to drive the car, and Glenda's like, you're still in second. It's the Italian transmission. Second is to the right. You know, and, like, I guess on one level, this is interesting, because it's like, in this whole section of the film, George Segal is trying to present himself as this, like, capable masculine presence who can, like, arrange the affair, drive the car, it's all going to be perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And at every step along the way, he's kind of emasculated.
Okay, I suppose that might be interesting, but you kind of have to look beyond the sitcom gags to see that.
You literally just, like, it's like a long shot of them driving down the road, and the sound is going like... And I'm sure 1973 audiences were just laughing uproariously in the theater at how funny
this
is.
Had a Fiat 600 once. Oh my gosh.
So then they arrive at the Golf Hotel in Malaga. And the next gag is about that completely relatable thing. We've arranged for a hotel in Malaga and we can't get a view of Gibraltar. So there's literally, like, I mean, I'm not getting, like, 7 minutes of them with a ludicrous quote-unquote Spanish bellhop, who again is probably not Spanish, like lugging their luggage from one room to the next, to the next, to the next. And they look out the window and say things like, does Gibraltar have a lot of washing on it?
I mean, that guy, that actor who played the Spanish guy, was clearly a Cypriot from North London.
I mean, he honestly, like, he is the most downtrodden person in this film. He has to deal with them yelling at him and trading, like, really stale repartee.
Yeah, he, at one point in the film, he's the center of a fight between them, where they're throwing their clothes at each other. He gets whacked by every single one of them.
Yeah. So basically, they finally settle into the hotel room after this disastrous plane, car, journey, and switching rooms three times. Glenda, as any sensible person would, just wants to go to bed, whereas George, as any red-blooded American male, wants to...
Stop.
Stop. Thank you for that. Now, Sean, you and I have been on a lot of holidays together. They've had their tense moments, and they've had their pleasantries.
Yes, one of them also involving a very small car.
Yes, okay.
can I just say on the record that Brian driving around in the narrow streets of Corfu in a Peugeot, whatever it is, the tiny ones.
With a manual transmission.
With a manual. You were incredible.
Yeah, okay? So George Segal, suck it. Yeah. I am pretty masculine, and my Vicky Alessio was swooning.
I honestly, whenever you drive a car, I'm so turned on.
Editing a podcast, however, complete opposite reaction.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So here we go.
I have selective impotence during that part.
Well, okay. So but the stick shift, baby.
Oh my god,
stick
yes.
Stick shift. So impotence and sexuality figures in prominently in this next section of the movie, because, and remember, after all these complications, they still have never kissed. They've definitely not had sex. I can understand why George Segal wants to have sex at this point, because let's be fair, Glenda is the one who demanded that before any of this could occur, they had to go on this trip, right? I know that George has planned it badly, but she was being very demanding, no?
Yeah, of course, she was being demanding, yes.
She spends most of this movie, like, looking at him from the side and, like, being quite snarky, or as George calls her, a cold-ass, supercilious British woman,
mm-hmm.
Yes? But basically, and again, here's this part of the movie that could be interesting, where she is talking about how she has to constantly stroke his ego, and indeed stroke his penis, to make him feel like a man. And he's constantly, like, failing at the ability to have sex with her.
It'll do us both the world of good.
You bet your ass. Now watch how this is better. I'm gonna press it in my book of memories.
You know what you should have been? A worm. A cestode worm. And do you know why? Because a cestode worm has a complete set of male and female sexual organs in each of its 100 sections and spends its whole life copulating with itself. Wouldn't that be lovely? You could have taken you away for the weekend. You would have had you all to yourself. And all those questions. Was I good? You were wonderful. Did the earth move? The house fell down? Am I manly? No, but you're a great worm. You missed your profession, a worm crawling and humping its way through life, and badly.
You know, there's these long extended sitcom-y moments themselves that we're not going to go into, involving him being bested by a child golfer, and then maybe
a child
golfer, and one of them that is almost important to the plot is when he pulls his back out just as they're about to make love for the first time, which puts him out of action, and which leaves the two of them, you know, separate from each other. The doctor says to him, don't try and make love until you can touch your toes again.
Now, I just want to point out why he throws his back out. So he gets on top of her to have a go, and then he turns his neck and says, you really can see Gibraltar, and then, like, screams bloody murder because he's thrown at his back, leading to, like, emasculating complications where the hotel doctor has to, like, snap it back in place. And Glenda is just rolling her eyes, thinking, like, how have I picked this man to have an affair with? I actually think we're making the movie sound a lot more fun than it actually
is.
No,
we're not. I have to really state on the record that this middle part of the film is really difficult to get through. It's really slow.
It's repetitive because it's the same kind of gag over and over again, and it really gets acrid and unpleasant. Like, George Segal, he does finally convince Glenda to have sex with him later after his back is healed. And then the thing becomes, I mean, they don't say this outright, but I can assume that it's because she didn't have an orgasm.
Yes.
Right? And George Segal just can't deal with the fact that she's bluntly telling him that the earth didn't move.
Okay, so again, this is a point where I'm thinking, okay, maybe this film was touching on certain topics that were risque and kind of sexy, and also a dynamic in interpersonal male-female relationships that just weren't talked about very much. But they're downtrodden by these poor jokes the entire time.
And also, like, scenes that have absolutely no structure or sense, because while they're having this conversation about female orgasms and male sexuality, and they're invoking things like, you know, Freud and all this kind of stuff, it concludes with them screaming at each other like maniacs, throwing clothes at each other from across the room, as you said, whacking the bellhop, and then they decide, you know what, this whole affair in the hotel is a fiasco, we're just gonna go into the car, drive back to the airport, we hate each other totally, and we're gonna go back home to London. But of course,
they can't get a flight.
Yeah, so they have to go back to the hotel, simmering with anger. And this is the point where they finally do have sex, yeah? Glenda invokes one of the most problematic but also memorable lines that she's ever uttered.
Well, we should contextualize it first. They're getting on top of each other, they're on the bed, they've just been fighting, and there's this moment where you can tell that the anger is turning itself into passion before their very eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He pulls off his shirt, she opens up her blouse, they're about to do it.
He, like, throws her onto the bed.
He's struggling with his belt, he's trying to get his pants off, and as you said, Glenda looks at him and says, with the most problematic line reading ever, "My one chance to get raped and you can't get your trousers off."
And I guess lines like that, maybe they sent a frisson through the audiences of 1973 who also, you know, loved Roman Polanski, you know, drugging a teenager. I don't know. The 1970s were a different time. But from that moment onward, okay, the entire plot of this sitcom has been how much they hate each other and how everything goes wrong. And then suddenly, they love each other, right? That suddenly it's all blissful. They're going to bullfights. They conveniently find a room in this hotel that has a keyboard and a drum set, and they perform like a duet together. And you're suddenly like, okay, like, I know that rom-coms are usually about how people don't realize they're in love and then they become in love, but like, they rarely do this kind of completely unbelievable 180. You know?
Yeah, especially so far into a film as well.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned the fact that like Paul Sorvino and his wife are trailing them around the hotel through all this and don't realize that they know each other. And then Paul Sorvino pulls George aside and is like, "I know what you're doing, mate." He doesn't call him mate. He probably calls him like...
Bro.
No, he probably calls him like, "You schmuck." "You're not a mensch, you schmuck."
"You putz."
Exactly right.
I love that word, putz.
He's like, "This is completely fakakta." So he pulls him aside and he says, "Do you know what? I was doing the same thing that you were. I was having an affair and I had to go through therapy and it cost me $18,000. But finally, there was one question that I couldn't answer. Do I love this woman enough to give her up?" So that's like the quote unquote serious bit of the film where he's like, "Don't go down this road. It's not going to end well." So Glenda and George, their trip has actually turned out well, even though it began badly, and they come back to London. How are they going to carry on with this arrangement, Sean, considering that George is married and Glenda has two children?
Who she loves so much.
She loves so much that we conveniently never see.
Ever again.
Ever, 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 ever again.
This is one of those films where, like, I can usually suspend my disbelief, but at several points in the film, I turned to Brian and said, "Where are her children?"
Because it creates a comic obstacle, like the idea that you wouldn't have a scene trying to explain what she should do with her children. Because actually, Glenda suddenly seems to be spending no time at home because George and Glenda do what?
They rent a flat on Macclesfield Street in Soho.
Can I say, this is also basically the plot of Harold Pinter's Betrayal,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did people really do this in those days? Like, were flats that cheap that they could just, like, have a flat to conduct their affair?
Well, first of all, they're not poor, the
two
of them.
No, that's true.
But second of all, yes, I think property prices were just cheaper, Brian, you know, and Soho wasn't the central location we know it for. It was a den of vice.
Yes, and in fact, the Soho that they get this flat is kind of right in the midst of Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the longest time, we have associated the BT Tower with this film, okay?
Yeah.
Because there are all these shots of them walking in and out of the flat or getting in and out of cabs, and in the background is the BT Tower, to the degree that Sean and I do not refer to the BT Tower when we were walking around London by its proper name. We call it...
It's Vicky Alessio Tower.
The Vicky Alessio Tower, just which makes no sense to anyone else.
Well, we also call Seven Dials the Albert Nobbs Memorial Obelisk. If you've seen Albert Nobbs, you know what we mean.
Yeah, for the explanation of that one, you'll have to wait till another series. So the other funny thing about this Soho flat that they get into is like the other tenants who are renting the flat. They all have one name, which is French. And no, it's not French and Saunders.
Yeah, now Brian, can you please explain this to me? Because I know they're all hookers. They're all sex workers.
They're whores.
They're whores, okay? But they all have the surname French, and I don't understand this. Can you tell me what this is?
It's obviously not their real name, yeah? So they're creating nom de guerre, nom de plume, nom de chemise. I don't know what it is, but, you know, whore names. Mm-hmm. So they picked the name French because French is associated with sexuality. But basically, they're all women who have flats that men come to pay them for sex. And when George Segal sees all these people named French on the buzzers, he says, "Do you think they're all related?" And Glenda says, "Only by price." It's a witty line.
It is a witty line.
It's a witty line. And there are witty lines throughout this film. But there's a lovely couple of moments where Glenda runs into one of the whores. And
the sex workers.
Okay, sorry, sex workers. They have these women. Like delightful...
Women. She runs into one of the women.
Yes. They have these delightful Cockney accents, and she says something like, "If it gets a bit busy any day, just send some of them upstairs to me, love."
Maud French.
Yeah, and then later... I mean, Glenda seems to live in this flat, right? Like, George comes and goes, but Glenda, like, sets it up. They have, like, books. They have a record player.
They do more than that. Like, they give it a whole paint job. Do you know what I mean?
They have candles. She cooks coq au vin. And at one point, she goes up to one of the Frenches, and she says, "Pardon me, do you have any oregano?" And the woman replies, "I got checked last month, thank you very much." And she says, "No, it's a herb."
Yeah, and then she goes to Dean Street to a deli. But what do we know Dean Street for, Ryan? For the greatest sexual health checkups in London.
We've been checked for oregano many times. Many times. All sorts of herbal growth. Yeah. Oh my god. Okay, this movie is full of repetitive gags, right? We had the repetitive gag of booking the relatives on the travel agent, the repetitive gag of the hotel rooms, and now we get an even more extended repetitive gag, which is George Segal has to lie to his wife about why he's going to the flat. Now, maybe one of these scenes might have had some delightful comic potential. Yeah, for instance, he tells her that he's going out to walk the dog. But what does he actually do?
He goes out to see Glenda, of course.
Right, he goes out to see Glenda, but he...
Is this a trick question?
Instead of walking the dog, he gets into a cab, drives clear across town to... Soho, presumably Stupser, gets back in the cab, goes back to his wife, and wah, wah, wah.
Forgets the dog.
He forgets the dog. And so then he has to make an excuse that the dog hasn't shat and, like, run back and get the dog and come back. And then this happens a number of times. The most extended one of this is when he and his wife are at a Beethoven concert at the Royal Albert Hall, and he, like, leaves in the middle of it to go meet Glenda, and then comes back and the concert is still going.
Joe, watching it the second time round, he only does that once. In my mind, I was like, oh, here we go. He has to leave the concert four times.
Well, no,
because you get so used to that happening.
Then finally, the wife is getting a bit frustrated with the fact that he's never around and he's never paying attention to her. And she insists that even though George has made this date to go meet Glenda on a particular day and a particular evening, and he says he's going to come at a particular time, she's like, "You have to come to me to the premiere of the new Pinter play. It's a benefit for UNICEF." Which is just, I guess, something that rich people do. They go to benefits for UNICEF.
Some things never change.
Yes, I wonder which Pinter play it was.
Betrayal, I hope.
I think Betrayal was a bit later than this
Ashes
film.
To Ashes.
It's probably The Caretaker. Anyway, so George has to go to the theater with the wife. He lies to Glenda. She happens to be walking out of the aforementioned deli on Dean Street, and she sees them, him and the wife, as they're leaving the theater. This is the straw that breaks Glenda's back. And here we finally come around to her big scene, the one that Oscar's greatest moments had determined was her greatest moment. So having been sitting on the side, being relatively cool through the whole thing, just being happy to trade witty barbs, she finally realizes, what am I doing? Uh-huh. I'm no better than any of these sex workers who are up and down all across this building. I'm essentially here as a sex worker for this one man who's treating me like shit.
If you want to take your wife to the theater, please do. Just don't give me any of this bullshit about $75 million and 85 billion ships.
It's no bullshit, only it was 45 ships and $70 million.
I am fed up with you. I am fed up with this arrangement. I am fed up with hanging around on the off chance that you may condescend to drop in between the baseball and the golf.
Vicky.
And if you do not have to take your children to Kew Gardens.
She finds this whole setup awful. You know, basically, she's fed up with this.
And in fact, she says, she's sick of all the lies, all the running around, and if you want a whore, just go out in the hall and buzz any of those doors marked French.
Yes, which is what you were always wondering what that meant from Oscar's Greatest Lives.
Yes, I mean, on Oscar's Greatest Moments, none of those words made any sense. Yeah. Even still, I'm not sure they make a lot of sense. Now, actually, as we describe it, A Touch of Class is in a weird way the comic version of Sunday Bloody Sunday.
Minus the bisexuality, of course.
Yeah, there's no bisexuality.
Unless Paul Sorvino has something to tell us.
Well, also Cecil, her gay friend with the muumuu, or caftan, whatever it is. But basically, yet again, Glenda plays a feminist who gets herself wrapped up in a situation where she's exploited by a man.
Yeah.
And then she has an awakening moment where she basically cuts him loose and is like, I'm going to stand up for my independence. Maybe this is Glenda's type.
Yeah, Glenda's type is a divorcee, headstrong, but, you know, susceptible to pain.
I feel like the same thing is sort of true in Women in Love as well, isn't it? Because she gets married, but yeah, she also is like carrying on other affairs. The classic Glenda character is someone who has the personality of a woman who's got it all together.
Yeah.
But under that facade, she has emotions that are difficult to deal with. And then eventually, by the end of the film, she tells the man to fuck off.
Yeah, because Glenda always plays a character with a temper to some degree.
Yeah, basically all of these films have exactly the same plot arc.
And what about Hedda Gabler? You've seen that, have you?
Hedda Gabler, she kills herself.
Okay, so maybe...
Spoiler alert to right. those who weren't around in 1878 when Hedda Gabler premiered.
Yeah. Damn it.
So anyway... Okay, Jean, the movie ends. She basically tells George Segal she's sick of all this, he apologizes, but then the next time that he comes to visit her at the flat, she's nowhere to be seen. She's gone off to find her children in whatever undisclosed location they've been squirreled away in, and she's done with this affair with George Segal.
Yeah, and this is the point where you had thought that there was some kind of coda at the end where they bump into each other.
Yeah, I thought maybe it has some circular structure where, you know, they run into each other again at the softball match and, like, look each other wistfully and say things like, your girl is lovely, Hubble. But then I remembered, oh no, that's another movie.
Yeah, and actually, this is where I have respect for A Touch of Glass.
Yeah.
You know, no, I'm serious.
In what way?
It's not a Hollywood ending. It's not.
It is, though. It is a Hollywood
ending. But it's not a romantic comedy ending.
No, because the romance fizzles out. We return again to the rain. George Segal looks out of the flat window in the rain, and he sees that Glenda has hightailed it out of there and is about to get into a cab and drive away and never see her again. As Glenda is going to the cab, yet another businessman tries to get into the cab with her,
yeah,
which is the exact way that this whole situation started. She looks at him witheringly.
Yeah, she asks him, are you married? And he says, yes. And then she says, you take it.
Wah, wah, wah. And then we get the ending of the movie. Yeah. And George and Glenda were never to meet again. Oh, that is until they made a second film with the same director.
Yes, 1979's...
Lost and Found.
Thank you, Brian.
I mean, if the comic delights of A Touch of Class have intrigued you, then you might also enjoy Lost and Found, which Sean only recently discovered, like, this morning, that this film even exists.
Yeah, it's like A Touch of Class on ski slopes. While visiting Switzerland, an American college professor, Adam, keeps running into a divorced British secretary, Patricia, wherever they go. Sound familiar? First their cars collide, then they smash into one another on a ski slope, each breaking a leg. Okay, so it's A Touch of Class with personal injury claims. In between numerous quarrels, the two develop lust and love. They hastily marry, but the disagreements continue. Mm. Patricia decides to leave, so Adam decides to fake a suicide. They lose each other and find each other again and again.
Let it be known, apparently A Touch of Class was enough of a hit that they re-teamed Glenda and George for Lost and Found. Paul Sorvino returns again.
Yeah, and Melvin Howard.
Melvin Frank has directed and written this film again. Like, Melvin Frank strikes me as the kind of person who had one idea once and kept recycling it. Which is like, divorced British women are very cold. Crazy, sex-starved American businessmen are very horny. I'll put the two of them together. Oh my god.
Okay, in defense, one last defense of A Touch of Class, okay?
Yes.
Back to that ending for a moment. In terms of, like, resolution, there's not even a moment where she says goodbye forever.
Right.
You know? That part where he's looking out the window and sees her waiting for a taxi, he doesn't run down out of the house to get her. It just fizzles out, you know?
Yeah, but is that good?
No, I think in terms of storytelling and what we're accustomed to in the romantic comedy genre, I kind of appreciate that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it does sort of start to feel, I guess, a bit like more like an emotional drama. There's a song by Shirley Bassey that plays called, I forget what it is. I was about to say, What a Waste of Time, but it's not that. It's something like All This Wasted Love. Although this movie was making me think, what a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because it is also, frankly, a waste of talent. George Segal is charming in his brash American way. Glenda is delivering straight up pure Glenda here in this movie.
Oh yeah,
right?
She's also gorgeous, we should say.
She looks gorgeous, both with her clothes on and her clothes off. There's a scene where she's suntanning. I've put two tubes of very expensive suntan oil all over myself. She looks great. She's delivering lines with impeccable laser-like precision.
Enunciating to the back row.
Yeah, I mean, she's giving us comic Glenda at its best. It's just that the movie is so execrably simple-minded.
Yeah, and feels much longer than it should be.
Now, Sean, here's my last question to you. Should I pitch to Netflix a 2018 reboot of A Touch of Class? Could we salvage something about this premise, but, like, update it to our current 21st century mores? Would I have to make them gay? Would I have, like, what would I do? Because A Touch of Class, you can see this premise of people who are having an affair, but complications ensue. It could be interesting, right?
Oh, absolutely. No, I genuinely believe the thing is that while the world they live in and some of the gags themselves are really outdated, the idea of two adults conducting an affair is still topical.
Yeah, so what would be your pitch for the updated version?
Well, I would say that Glenda is far more, you know, sticks to her feminist guns. Because, you know, the word feminism is never mentioned in this film. It's obviously, I guess, because she's a working woman, you know, with her own independence. I guess she's supposed to be a feminist, or a woman's liber, at least. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think in this, you know, the guy would probably be more of a traditional pig. And she would be much more of a woman who should know better.
Well, I think actually the more interesting take on it for 2018 would be the guy thinks he's really woke and thinks he's really down with feminism, but he's constantly revealing how clueless he is. And in the kind of like that Aziz Ansari Me Too story that came around.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, he's the sensitive guy, but actually when it comes down to it, he reveals just as many kind of boorish, self-interested traits as anybody else, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe we could just pitch it to Michael Lucas as A Touch of Ass.
Yeah, A Touch of Ass.
Yeah, yeah.
Starring the Men of Israel, yeah?
That's so 2002, darling.
Oh, pardon me.
Get yourself up to date.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's Cocky Boys. It's Cocky Boys.
Yeah, it's Cocky Boys. What Whoopi Boys.
They have so, very high production values.
Brian, are we recommending A Touch of Class? I'm going to say no.
I think it's a popcorn night if you're ready to skewer a film and
then skewer yourself afterwards.
It's really hard to find as well, I have to say. So
yes. Hard to find legally.
Yeah. If you have enjoyed listening to us talk about A Touch of Class, you might enjoy A Touch of Class, but by enjoy, I mean hate it. So probably just, if you want more of it, just re-listen to this episode again, and then our ratings will climb even higher.
I heard Ellen Burstyn had to get an exorcism after she lost to Linda Jackson for this.
I have a question. Could we ever, like, petition the Academy to, like, rescind Oscars? I'm sure someone thought about this in terms of, like, Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Like, Glenda committed no crimes by robbing Barbara Streisand of the Oscar for The Way We Were. But, yeah, sure, okay, Glenda has two Oscars, but she got two Oscars in rapid succession in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Barbara Streisand so deserved the Oscar for The Way We Were more than Glenda in A Touch of Class.
Do you know what we should do? We should just redistribute the Oscar winners.
Yeah.
We'll take Barbara's for Funny Girl,
mm-hmm.
and we'll give it to Barbara for The Way We Were.
Yeah.
And then we'll...
Because actually, in that year for Funny Girl, Catherine Hepburn won for The Lion
and Winter Spell, yeah.
So two were given out. So there's an extra Oscar, like, flying around somewhere.
And then we'll also take Glenda's for A Touch of Class and give it to her for Sunday Bloody Sunday.
But no, if we do that, then Jane Fonda doesn't have one for Clute.
Okay, no, you can't do that.
This is like the butterfly effect if we start switching these things around. Next thing you know, Matthew McConaughey will end up with about five somehow.
Yeah.
No, we don't want to play God, Sean. We don't want to play God. If A Touch of Class has taught me anything, don't play God.
Yes.
And don't go to Malaga.
No. Well, Malaga is not a place to go anymore.
Okay. Sean, we have one more Glenda Jackson curiosity. One last dance to dance. To dance. Have you got your veils ready?
Yes, all seven of them, Brian. I'm ready to go.
Okay. We'll put on our green carnations for a really weird film as the final installment of this series. And exactly what that film is will be unveiled on our Twitter account, teased at you, at Broad Appeal Pod. You can find me at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Glenda, if you're listening, we still love you. You can keep that Oscar. Just use it to bludgeon a few Tories.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to do now, Brian? I'm going to go and vote.
All right. See you very soon, everybody.
Bye. Let's do another one, okay? She's got cool that can't be schooled, and a touch of class.
Record that pod and fuck that bod. It's
such a touch of class.
It's just a touch of,
just a touch, too much of, just a touch of class.
Of class.
Of class.
Of class.
No, no, keep going.
Touch a touch a touch a touch a touch a touch a class.
Touch a touch a touch a touch a class.
Touch a class, touch a class. Of class. I have been touched by class.
Eat your food and don't be good. Have a touch of class, there's loads.
If we only could have guessed that it wouldn't stand the test, we'd have played it off the jest and have been each other's guest. We'd have smiled and walked away while it still was light and gay. But now here's that rain. If we held back a bit, every time.